Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming to support our Michigan Writers event, particularly on a night like this. I'm Stephanie Mattson, the library's publicity coordinator and an assistant in library instruction. It's my great pleasure to introduce to you tonight not one but two esteemed poets, Dennis Heinrichsen and Joseph Featherstone. Joseph Featherstone, a Harvard graduate and native of Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, is one of the founders and faculty leaders of the acclaimed teacher education program here at Michigan State. He has taught at Harvard and Brown universities, served as principal of the Commonwealth School in Boston, and was for many years editor of the New Republic, where he wrote on education, politics, and literature. He is the author of two books on education and school reform. His poems and articles have appeared in publications ranging from The Nation, The Atlantic Monthly, and The New York Times, to the Harvard Education Review, Plowshares, and The Burning Tree. His first poetry collection, Braces Cove, was published in September 2000 by the New Issues Press at Western Michigan University. Currently, Professor Featherstone, who divides his time between Gloucester, Massachusetts and East Lansing, is at work on another volume of poems. Dennis Heinrichsen, a native of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, earned his BA in English from Western Michigan University and an MFA in creative writing from the University of Iowa. Among his awards are a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts, grants from the Michigan Council for the Arts, and prizes from the Carolina Quarterly and Poetry Northwest. He has published three full-length volumes of poetry: The Attraction of Heavenly Bodies, The Rain That Falls This Far, and The Garden of Earthly Delights. The last collection, published by Akron University Press last September, was awarded the press's 1999 Poetry Prize. Currently, Mr. Heinrichsen resides in Lansing and teaches at Lansing Community College. The format for this evening's readings, is that each poet will read for 20 to 25 minutes, with Mr. Heinrichsen going first. Discussion will follow after Mr. Featherstone's reading. Now please join me in welcoming Joseph Featherstone and Dennis Heinrichsen.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks to Peter Berg and MSU for inviting me and Jay to read tonight. I want to begin with a poem that for me locates me geographically. I lived in Grand Ledge for a long time and would hunt poems. As one of my teachers, John Woods, said, you'd go out and court a poem. This was a poem I courted. I went to the Grand Ledge Park and watched people fish next to the wastewater treatment facility, which on a Sunday morning, so these associations came together in a poem called Drawn to Water. So this is where the used condoms swirl, as pale and blind as deep water fish of desire slackened, wads of Kleenex, leaves, butterflies and moths in sugary amber. All around the three-stage ponds, oak roots angling in, seeking the cracks and leachings. Downstream, diaphanous webbings, swags of ether. Idle Sunday, they hold me in and hold the river back so it can heal me, good horse spangling the drop through. Can bless our town's poor who are here now fishing. They eat what they catch with its skewed anointing. They're up to their ankles in the river, muttering Chinese and Spanish, a beautifully damaged English, sunlight hesitantly reddening their bare necks and open collars. I could quote them Ovid, maybe, describe the metallurgical blur in a drop of lake water, or what floods from the sewers when it rains hard here, and they just laugh and lay their soft arcs back across the water, reel them in with a whipsaw ratcheting. And they're right, maybe. The contaminants are inlaid elsewhere, risen wafer and tongue to another cool precinct. They're not here in the daylight, spilling upstream its skid of lumber, not in the soft, methodical thrashings of the paddle wheel. It's different now that it's afternoon. I should talk instead of how an April heat spiked early. The forsythia's ablaze in a fury of pollen. The night's gone dry mouth, gone cotton mouth too sudden. How waking we splash ourselves with chilled expected purity, gulp it down by the handfuls. As I read that, I realize my basement is full of water, as is maybe some of yours, too. When I was a child, one of the greatest pleasures was being able to burn trash, which you can't do anymore. You had a big old barrel at the end of the yard, and Ohio blue tips, the self-combustible ones that you can't get anymore, or your father's Zippo. This was in the 60s and was in a small neighborhood in Iowa. One of our neighbors was a strange man. He dug into his yard coffee cans and built a kind of miniature 18-hole golf course. He would get paint brushes out and old coffee cans full of water and have the kids come by and paint his house. What else did he do? All sorts of things to lure the residents to his yard and the kids there. And we all thought it was the greatest thing in the world. It was community. Years later, we found out, of course, that he was a child molester, and what he was doing was making the children feel comfortable and coming over to his house so that they would come when the parents were gone or not around, and we found that out many, many years later. And it begins with, the poem's called Trash Fires Burning Up and Down the Alley. It's kind of for my members of my family. I was lucky enough, I only got beat up by the child molester's molester in training, his middle son. But I got to set fire to trash, and the poem begins there. The poem's called Trash Fires Burning Up and Down the Alley. There on delicate folds of Kleenex lie our mother's kisses. Her soft lips muted, repeated 100 times, it seems, and left to sleep there as weightless doves until our father's Zippo snaps and they are briefly kited for an instant, fully liquid. And then everywhere is fire, tongues and sheets of fire. I'd be punched out from flailing at air and sore in the ribs, so I just sway in the bleeding twilight, hauled down, roped and knotted, swinging by my heels from the oak like bait or a new lamb. In another yard, children laughing and screaming beneath the shuttlecock. One or two others, perhaps you among them, painting soft jungle landscapes on a gray-green clapboard, the shapes evaporating, shrinking to ferns and jellyfish and primitive masks. The child molester, whose world this was, angling effortlessly among us, freshening our parents' drinks or coaxing one of the fathers to play accordion. Some days I can't help thinking about that summer coolness everywhere, daylight hammering in its full August fury the grain of the roofs, the child placed just so beside a tool, or the body standing, muscles rigid, so as not to graze with bare flesh, small of the back or buttocks, wings of the shoulder blade, the cold edge of aluminum. What can it mean to be set fully naked at the beginning of your life inside a garbage can, somebody's father pounding with twice straightened nails, a carport, somebody's mother, ours, singing Sarah Vaughan to the sunset. Somewhere in the great expanse of evening, the lone child wandering. So many thresholds. The bird in the sky, a blue jay, the color of chalk, rain like stilettos of mercury. You're 4 again, or 30. You lean toward the hose, both of you own homes now, one of you has children. The water shooting too hot at first because it's been baked in the coil, but then flooding to a drinkable coolness. I never witnessed this, though. I would always ask my father to tell this story. He ran away from home and joined the Navy, and in a great act of rebellion, began to mispronounce the family name. One drunken night, he got a tattoo, and much to his dismay, when he came back, I think he was just sort of shocked by the fact that he had this tattoo. So he got one of those old milk cartons and a bottle of Aqua Velva and a Schick double edge and worked at the tattoo, which, you know, does that same thing to me. So he's got this sort of botched scar here, and it seemed therefore emblematic of something. And the emblem, I guess, is sexual, erotic. Perhaps he felt he couldn't get married, and you know, in the 50s, if you had a tattoo to a certain kind of woman. So the poem's called A Fish Story, and I think has to do with one of the setups that I was trying to think of is how we know as kids, without really knowing, that our parents are having sex. They still have physical life, despite the fact that they've got four kids running around. And this poem is kind of tries to get at that sort of recognition without really stating it. It's called A Fish Story. And the poem tries to take a temperature, I think, which is the reason for the first image. Water was as good as mercury the night I dropped the catfish in and watched it swirl calmly, clockwise, counterclockwise against the pail's dented sides. From the top, it was all false volume, wind-filled, water-filled, as beautiful as a scarf, some lightweight metal, miraculous alloy. I watched it swim for hours. Now and then, I'd curve my hand into the pail and let the dorsal, pectoral cut of the gill scrape my fingers, skinny wrist. Even then, I knew it was dying. Its steel blue, the same steel blue along my father's forearm, witnessed the botched scar, the uneasy mix of ink and tissue, where he calmly razored until his tattoo bled. How out of it issued to a son, desire's mute howl. Iowa farm boy, Tsingtao pier, a hooker bargaining for the gold of his wire-rimmed glasses, sunlight like gunshot near the breakwater. Smell of creosote, moss, negotiation, the reflections twisting, bleeding silks on the uncertain texture of the harbor. At least, that's what I thought the night my mother sang and my father ignited charcoal. The fish in the pail slowly circling, her hands, then fingertips on the spray of his wound, as if she could delay what I had culled from thin walls and ceilings, from cracks in the door, his quick eyes suddenly bluing to hesitant laughter. Two of the guiding spirits in the book are my mother's parents, both now deceased. My grandmother had Alzheimer's, which is a strange phenomena. You kind of not only watch the person deteriorate, you watch yourself disappear as well. And when you look for connection to that other, you don't see yourself there. The shared memories are gone. It's kind of frightening. This poem's called 100,000 Lines Ending in Haiku, and it's about me trying to, at least during the early stages, tell stories to spark that memory, that connection, to not only see her, but to also see myself in her. It's for my mother's mother. What was beautiful in her arc of thought is still mid-January in elegance. She's cold, so she turns it up 80, 90 degrees before her pace slackens and she gazes at snow. Her hand at her throat, something fluttering, her mind absently sifting columns and wedges of daylight. There's no sadness in it, only gaps of language and her forgetting, knitted roses pilling at her sweater's breast line. Sometimes I think the misery is just some small nick inside the cell work, some slack metal, noxious ore poisoning the system, calling out to her as it did to him with anger and with such sure logic, angelic lures driving her naked to the glass. Once at 30,000 feet, I saw how forgetting might work, lightning stabbing with such dull prongs the unworkable mass again and again. The whole sky lay coiled, stilled, all of it inverted and pointed at heaven. 3 days I've tried to startle her with memory. The purple martins in their two-storied home, the Roosevelt dimes all fled to some afterlife, herons stalking the current. Here's what Narcissus wanted, a piece of the self in another made manifest, emotion reefing the ponds and mineral shallows, something human rising out of the networks, combustible, kinetic, not this cold narcosis, ethereal mist, because her heart, tireless engine, simply cups what it sees, a blood rose, and passes it on. The other spirit of the book is my mother's father, my grandfather. It's a young man. He had perfect pitch. He could hear a song and play it, reproduce it on the organ. Beautiful singer. Got a job repairing boilers and slowly lost the ability to hear. So his perfect pitch was lost. He leaned in to machines to try to figure out what's going on there. He did miss, among the things he missed were bird call. And he would get up very, very early in the morning so he could go outside where it was very, very quiet and crank up his hearing aid to hear the birds singing until somebody, you know, coughed or slammed a door and he'd have to turn it back out. This poem was called Perfect Pitch, playing both on the idea of mimicking a sound and also the idea of black, perfect pitch, death. This then was one of the city's minor boilers, and he tending it, a cripple to the gods, though in truth he was my mother's father and kept the upper building Kilbourne photo in steam and heat. It was here in 1958 that I first learned the undercurrent was rhythm, stemmed in runs of piping and ruptured seals, skeletal, celestial, a three-dimensional network feeding our hearing. It was, finally, a kind of oil slung in the inner ear, coating the hammer and anvil, the fiber optics, greasing the long slide into the chambers of the brain. How my grandfather could stand there listening beyond the second set of doors and know by the reverberations flashing across the opening which valve needed closing, which needed opening, his perfect pitch. And so by music, diligent labor, he tuned machines. His territory, pre-war, during the war, parts of Wisconsin and western Illinois, the equipment, Clayton steam generators and rotary churns, the calculus of pressures and volumes, optimum scaldings, registering in the gauges as pure tone, feedback. A rhythm finally of waters making that destroyed his hearing, the drum skin tearing and hardening over, the hammering, hissing, dry wind in an abandoned shaft. For a time then, laughing it off, for a time rising at 6 a.m. to let the birds leak in on their particles of song, each note lashed to a particular spot in the landscape, and he following, his hearing aid throttled to maximum volume. Oh, tall tree in the ear. Whitman at Timber Creek wrestling the saplings. My grandfather lies down now in the planet's ear, dead stone at the center. He hears nothing of the raucous sparrows pecking at breadcrumbs, nothing of the bell note of the jays, nor how the morning doves signal mid-wire evening above the tomato vines, their fluted notes, the texture and purity of milk. Time I start. You get up here, you forget what time you started. The Shroud of Turin went on tour many years ago, like a Elvis impersonator, and ended up at the Lansing Center, and I managed to drag my poor daughter there and my parents there, knowing that there would be a couple of poems in it, and this is one of them. The guards looked like Art Carney and Jackie Gleason. The thing itself was gorgeous. I wanted it. It was a full-size replica of the Shroud of Turin. It looked like this gorgeous moth swing. But I listened in and moved in and out and heard these guys talking about how it was repaired at one point. And then I moved back out so I could write the poem without having to pay any attention to the truth. So I imagine these nuns in kind of quilting bee repairing the Shroud of Turin. It's called repair work. They must have bled as they sang. The needles so quick through the linen, the frayed mesh, the silvers must have stung them. Pinpricks they must have stemmed with their tongues, unembarrassed, these brides of Christ, like sewing patches of sunlight to water. The ghost in the cloth lay double across their laps. These are the hips of Christ, knees raw bone inking the linen, this the stain of a coin that graced his eye. The image is yet unpatterned, available only should they dare to look in random angles, stitches. Terrible gash at a medial rib, imprint, sole of his foot, the other merely heel, curve of a branch at its one end blackened, released to ash. Their fingers as furious as sparks in the medieval dusk, repairing a fire. They must have wept as they bled, as they sang. I was debating whether or not I should read a new poem, and I guess the debate is won. I'm going to read it, so. The poem's called Partial Glimpses of the Face of Jesus, and I don't know where that came from. I was seeing a sequence of photographs of a person's face from different angles, and you really couldn't see the person's face, and I was taking a lot of walks outside and seeing things and trying to come to the understanding of the Blake line that everything that lives is holy, and trying to connect with that. And the poem's, and this poem sort of is a tour of, it's about a walk, basically, in one sense, trying to find that thing. Partial glimpses at the face of Jesus. The hand pulled back from water is always partially gloved with water, as a soul must be, gazing through a river's staggered brilliance, cloudwork lighting the weave of trout. Something a stiff wind could evaporate, or fingers leak back to the water. Or fingers leak back to the river. The same river moving now, undulant before me. Spirit infusing spirit along a rip in gravity. Current in it like a corkscrew, silt riding high on the rain's torque, then tiring in a long, dull, nutrient curtain. Revelation swifter there for certain fish, sunlight glossing even the spray of stones. How could I ever hope to contain such radiance, another presence next to mine, touching mine, inside me like a liquid metal? A slur in the heart or blood carried as easily, as uneasily, as word carries matter. I know the flicker's cry now, two short bursts of repeatable longing, and where the woodpecker nests, its song inside, then outside of the tree. A starling on a dead limb hovering as I hover, wanting to steal its home, our attention to something beautiful given. As the cranes are, or the pepper-black gathering of clouds. My driving parallel to the sunset for a while in a burnt orange light, radio playing, then cutting along a back road, belief so rife in the fields and yards, the cattle lie down around it, horses shuttle into the wind, galloping right up to the edge of wire. And a creek there, too, flattened backwater, blister of scum and weeds. I took two photographs near this place once and stacked them into a single shot, a deer's carcass up close matching the contour of the creek, so that it was a single body of water, something in the pliant ribs mirrored exactly in the pattern of swaying reeds. As if the animal had paused in that last terrible inrush of breath and held it there until the truck passed and the water stilled, and its eyes drained of color. And then, of course, the daylight whistling, its long spears marring the chamois. Torso and water, my own body and water, the smell of the deer like a garment thrown down from the afterlife. Somewhere in the tall grass, a golden bird, mules in a shaded grove as magnificent as palominos, a heron, I thought, drinking from their pool, two-dimensional at first in the water's glazed aspect, then suddenly alert to presence, full-bloomed, wide-winged. Two deer, later, staring back at me from their side of this trespass. A poem called On a Phone Call with Two Televisions. The narrator is on a phone with his father. The narrator's watching the reruns of the L.A. riots, the Reginald Denny beating. The narrator's father is watching how-to pornography. And it's spring. On a phone call with two televisions. Now yesterday's riot streams over the current as an ongoing now. The man already bled but there again bleeding in the Los Angeles blast zone, crawling on stunned hands in front of his truck, the good eye hovering nearly weightless in its turning back over to record our trance, side of the foot to the stomach, a concrete block unbelievably raised and brought to the head. My father just keeps on talking. For his part, watching pornography, a man and woman groveling ever louder into his partial deafness so his nerve ends snap and his heart thrashes like a sunfish in his hooded chest. What can I do but listen? Through the grains and spun strands of the cable, the planet's groundswell, riots of yellow pollen shifting like great seas in the wind. In the nest of my ear, the distortions of AT&T whistling subsonic like a sprouting grass, all of it in fragments and accidents of attention, a crude sampling arguing spirit, each man gluing one side of his hearing brain to the miraculous pixels. Pornography and deafness, murderously good fucking and deafness. A pale blue spider darts here, not there, beside the blood-red coffee mill. To its elemental phlegm, my daughter thumbs it. Says it's time for school. My father just keeps on talking. Over the commercials and political lip sync, holding up each new surgery's harvest like a string of perch. The local weather indistinguishable from the rioting and his dying. My daughter's school lunch into the process. I've soft bread in my hands. Her walking in later to butterfly a kiss into the matrix. Something. My television clicks. A voiceover prints through the shine of my ear. It's my father gasping to say it's spring again. In Iowa just now, a goldfinch has landed in his maple. Thank you very much.
That was wonderful. I love Dennis's poetry, but I even love it more when he reads it. The way this goes tonight is that I'm going to read my stuff, and then Dennis and I are going to have a press conference. I think just about everything I'm going to read comes from this collection of Braces Cove, which recently came out in the fall. Braces Cove is an actual geographic place just north of Boston in Massachusetts. It's the north side of Gloucester Harbor. I'll start with a poem. Not all the poems in this book connect to that, but a lot of them do. And this one starts off with it. It's called Coastal Work. The only thing you need to know about it is that the Rosa rugosa, the common beach roses that you see on the West Coast, on the East Coast, and on the Third Coast, around in the Great Lakes. Those beach roses are actually migrants from China. They're not, they're natives. They actually come from China, and they're originally immigrants. Coastal work. At the market, the Chinese cook courts Yankee scorn by buying chicken feet for soup stock. Such delicate flavor, blossoms opening in an old Chinese print. Granite bosses gave the newcomers jobs, laundering New England's air. The migrants offered their home silks to the terns, holding the wounded coast together, hanging tough when nativist northeasters went berserk. We Irish rolled in on the same fogs. One slim girl stole money for passage. My grandmother shamed my father's American boyhood by snatching horse manure off the streets. She used it to bank flowers as fine as a child's cheekbone. My mother was another of the fog people, a named Irish rose, born and buried inland, though she loved sea crossings. She always scrubbed the counters for a fiesta, and she would clap today to see fellow immigrants gathering at Brace's Cove. I see her partying with the Chinese philosophers at the blue top of the vernacular beach, offering thanks for ruby hips, shaking her head with the old-timers over the new coins for happiness. I see her joining other exiles in praise of the three lasting things, growing rice, poetry, and children. I see her doing essential coastal work, translating it fresh on threatened beaches, a formal ancient beauty, turning the immigrant's old prophet on bird feet. I think there'll be some echoes back and forth between some of Dennis's poems and mine tonight. Some of that's unintentional and some of that's intended. Here's a grandfather poem. It's called My Grandfather Was Ed Traynor. That's my mother's father. In a lost black and white city, the photo shows four matchstick men tending a mammoth Delaware and Hudson steam engine, number 923. The faces of his crew look wary. He wears a bow tie under the foreman's cap he learned to doff to bosses. Once he tore the lapels off his son's rented tux. In the war, he was my father, telling me not to fear the broken Jesus made of brass, that FDR would help out with Mrs. Neal, that I must speak well to my cat colors, that pine trees heal, that spit is wasted on a man who lives off others. There are not very many political poems in this book, but there are. I am a political poet, and there is one poem I'd like to read. I was an activist against the war in Vietnam many years ago, and this poem is called Less Passion. Actually, I was a speechwriter for a presidential candidate, and this comes out of that experience. Less Passion. Our neighbor's son, the Vietnam vet, walked to the retreat house when the path was still white with Quaker ladies, stood beside the granite cairn built by hikers and seekers, soaked himself in gasoline, and lit the match. For South Bend in the 68 primaries, the candidate asked me to write another speech. I saw the parts falling from my friend's obsolete marine chopper over the hills of Khe San, the last peace candle stuck begging on the iron fence around the White House as we threw up their fog of tear gas. The senator and his aides told me they wanted less passion. The neighbor's son was alone. We were an emergency squad. We had the truck, the siren. How did we lose him on his dirt road? At the cairn, I light a tin lantern. One shadow takes giant steps. Hello, pilgrim. Keep traveling. Home burned before you did. Part of these poems reflect my experience of growing up in Japan right after World War II. And this is a scene out of that. It's playing with the kids of a school for the blind right next door to where we lived in Yokohama. Some of them were blind because of the U.S. firebombings. The whole city was, Japanese cities were still in ruins. At the blind school, Yokohama, 1948. A stranger here is one who sees. The blind in school uniforms, gaijin in jeans, are playing night games, hide and seek, out where the blind know the terrain. Fireflies make lanterns in bamboo thickets. In summer's night cage, young boys are crickets, silenced, moonstruck, almost lost. Some blind from birth, some from firebombings. Sato gropes with hands out, a dancing ghost. He moves close now, his fine blank face, the color of a moth's wing, his damaged eye glittering like snail shine. In cool fire bursts, I feel his hand mothy on the new bamboo with mine. And this is another of those Japanese poems. And the pressure of imagined violence. It's called Dragonflies. My cousin said they could sew children's mouths with blue needles. Some kids called them snake doctors, with power to raise a dead copperhead to life or write your name on their air. As my secrets grew, I became better instructed concerning dragons and the bright colors of their wheels. In Japan, a woman taught me they were friendly, killing pests, appeasing ghosts. When she lost her child to firebombs, the sharp-eyed skimmers drew her to water salted with tears. Drew her to water salted with stars. Above the shut faces of wars and pond lilies, we prayed for the baby and ate our rice. We saw the nymph's skin split from a force inside, a fresh thing hardening, full of new shadow, like cooling glass. I came as close to them one other time. Therefore, I never ask for too much from the double-winged doctors. A mouth ripped open, new words for smoke, for sorrow. This one's called Remembering a Japanese Song on Eastern Point on a July Evening. At dinner, steam, bluefish, the old big life, my small existence now. My grown daughters love Brooklyn, two bites in the apple. I scrub skin and scales off family plates, take the trash out. Smelling privet and no raccoon, I step into new night, Orion low in the ash tree, the Milky Way pouring down. From the lake of darkness below my feet, fireflies rise toward Venus. What is the old song? Water lilies, filling with rain, tipping, filling again. There are some poems in this collection about children, my children. One of them's about when our son Jody died. He had cerebral palsy and was blind. My middle daughter, Caitlin, was extremely close to him and had asked to share a room with him. So we were very worried when he died about what her reaction would be, and this is about her reaction. The poem's called Caitlin. To be seven when a brother dies, to have shared a room, her silence frightened us. One night, she rose from the table and climbed to the top of the stairs. We heard the small voice singing each of the songs from the funeral service. The next morning in school, she announced to her class, "I am ready for questions now." And I have special permission to read this poem from my daughter Miranda, who's here, also here tonight. This is Bring Your Daughter to Work Night. And I'm very glad because I like the poem, and it's not always, one doesn't always assure of permission, such permissions. It's called Miranda Wears Her First Glasses at 11, when you first get a pair of glasses. The young owl in denim scans all surfaces, sampling the ore-colored grain of cedar, the purples and coffees and ivories of skin. At first, the parking lot tilts her off balance. Now the floors tamely follow her toward a horizon that widens and grows. Once a blood mystery under a cloudy cuticle, the new moon looks razor cut. She has become an authority on dirt, hunting all the near distances for fresh prey. "Our faces look jaggy," she says, "new and fierce and needy. We might be mountains and born again." A few of these poems, I think, crisscross again with Dennis's in a sort of at least a contemplation of spirituality. It might be too much to say that they're religious, but maybe spiritual would be the word. Here's one. Prayer. When my kids came, I wrote in a black leather chair. I met my father's eyebrows in the morning mirror. When the blind fever called, we had to obey. Now my snowy cat canters to the melting edge where the storm-split ash sweeps in the early light. Every wild thing is home. Every one of us is named. My soul's last child is stretching out her arms. And then one more of these. That, whatever that genre is. This one's called Prayer Rug. And Boris, the who's mentioned in this, is not a person, but rather a cat. It says that, but it's a source of complication in our family. Prayer Rug. The red looks like a meadow for bare feet, where Boris the cat, president of all the Russias, likes to sleep. My daughter sits drawing a man and a woman, fire blazing out of their hair. Never look into distances. Look at threads, or you may become a surrendered person, turning in snow toward camel bells. Let's sit here with our coffee, slices of peach, and talk above the hammer that pounds a life into gold flakes. Jesus said one word, and Lazarus heard the creek filling on a dry hill. Who besides that risen man, wiping crumbs of dirt from his lips, can report all that is lavished, all that is taken? We sit on a small terrace worked over by hand. There are a few poems in this collection that have to do with the experience of being a cancer patient and being treated for a very nasty lymphoma. And so this poem goes out to all the people in the room who know people. Either that's happened to you or you know people, I'm sure. And this one's called Bird Watching. After radical cancer treatment, isolation in a lead-lined room, I'm so radioactive, the books I handle are dangerous. The computer is plastic wrapped for protection. After he checks my levels, the technician backs away. With his binoculars, I watch out the sealed window for warblers and finches in tall evergreens. Down on the canal path, there are sandpipers. Once in a storm, an eel breaks the pewter surface, its silver and black body rippling with thunder. Through the lead half door out to the corridor, I talk to my unseen neighbor in the next room. Robert is amazed when I report two eagles snagging sunfish in the canal. There is a freshness the sick long for, like the fragrance from cedar. Robert calls it God. I want it now, with my radioactive blood and the glow of my brain. I caught it in the shadow of the eagle's eye, a greeting and a continual farewell. Under these hot lids, a second sight. Whatever happens to us, I say to the friend I have never seen, birds will enter this room. I don't know what to say about this poem, except sometimes weird poems come to you. It's called Onions, and it's deeply somber. Onions. Now that the law has forbidden crimes against onions, beauty and thanks spread. The confident new flag displays one the size of a willow bud next to another bigger than a boxer's fist. Tears remain, of course, and days of sweated work, the right measures of sorrow for leaving or staying. The knives cutting layers stop at acceptable cruelty. People discover translucence and reason. Hard old hands grow busy giving milk to little ones, local corn and delicate, mysterious soup for all. A marigold lights each table, and every human heart gathers the courage to disappear. Some of these poems in this collection are love poems. This is a love poem for mathematicians and computer nerds who also, of course, fall in love. It's called A Red Spider. A red spider crawls across your computer screen. She is tiny, a point you would insist, with no area. I'm a no-nonsense sort who prefers hearty soup to broth, and unlike you, I hate math. The spider is lecturing softly, mathematics, it seems, with special attention to geometry. I'm vulnerable, like the slave boy to whom Euclid gave a scornful penny for wanting learning to pay off. You must begin with ill-defined terms, says the spider. This is the real secret of mathematics. Then you hang your life on them with fierce rigor, like a well-made web floating in air. Mathematics offers an order based on desire, parallel to the life we must live. I will touch, the spider says, only in passing, on the scandals of irrational numbers, the depressing behavior of negatives, the infinite generosity of primes, the noble and radiant ease of perfect numbers. I stress only the elements, equals added to equals, the whole greater than the sum of its parts, the wild longing that drives the soul to the edge because of the line that can be drawn from one point to another. The title poem of this collection, Braces Cove, is of course about the cove, but it's also a love poem. So I'll toss it into the pile here. Braces Cove. On our early morning walk, we discover a small city left on the beach by unknown builders. Thigh-high towers of pink and gray granite, warmed by chunks of sea-smoothed brick that once made houses. You ask me to wipe the sunblock from your face. I do, careful with the eyes and mouth. Best of all are the standing stones, druid figures piled up from rocks and set out so the tide will wash their feet before it knocks them down. Erect amid the flowing green spartina grasses, they tilt their oval shoulders as if it were bad luck to say, so close to paradise. And then the last poem I'm going to read is called Ink. And it's not as shocking a story as Dennis's father's tattoo. But it's the story of my tattoo. Ink. The only confusing thing about this poem is that it begins as a memory of when I was 16 and had a job on a ship. And then the last few lines are now, sort of right after cancer treatments, and especially the way when your skin comes back, you're more conscious of your skin. Ink. Summer as a deckhand on a freighter between Yokohama and San Diego. I was 16, thin, white American with freckles and green eyes. I had to promise my older shipmates I would get a tattoo when we landed. Chipping rust, reading Melville, trying to be a man, I became a connoisseur of body art. I would not admit to love, so a heart with an arrow was out. Ditto the name of the girl. No jokes or obscenities, too ugly, and anyway, my parents would never stand for them. I rejected a warlike rising sun, the smoking pistol on the cook's calf, teardrops drawn as musical notes, matching Maori bats on the shoulder blades. Mom in little flowers, do unto others in gold. A sacred heart impaled by black thorns on a slim young Filipino hand appealed, my Catholic instincts homing in on depth through suffering. I was drawn to red flames of sacrifice, to a Tibetan storm cloud on the arm of an old sailor from Formosa, the seal of one of the 12 bodhisattvas. We were delegates from the world's fecund, chaotic variety, its lack of agreement on symbols. What mark would let me be known? Pain is short, I thought. An image tells the tale inside. Choosing to clothe my body in the colors and troubles of permanence would be like growing up, finding love or faith, a life's work. Sometimes in my doubts, I craved simplicity, the tiny glyph for a dragon's breath worn by an enigmatic Japanese mate. Even better, though, would be what I saw in my bunk as I fell asleep, a whale snaking in sea gardens, or lines etched in night's blood, a truth attained by dust-covered asters at dusk, a map of the earth made starry by mildew. One bright angel blew backward from the future toward me, like Queequeg's tattoo in Moby Dick. Her knowledge put an end to shame. Each piercing, every tear on my skin's surface pulled me through to another space, a blue-veined moth set in my sun-scorched and paint-stained hand revealed prints made by a vast beauty, the blue Pacific place where rains are born. Ashore, four of us had beers and hailed a cab. I was scared, undecided, but ready to be stippled and printed and inked. The place was closed. I peered through steel shutters at a Chinese dragon, mermaids with blonde hair, Semper Fi, anchors and chains, Bugs Bunny and Yosemite Sam posing next to pirate treasure. Our shore leave ended. Tonight, after radiation, I touch fresh skin. I hear the roar as the jeeps of the Marine MPs make the last sweep of the San Diego docks. I stand looking for the needle, my illumination, hungry naked arms pressing against the locked ink shop. Thanks very much. Yeah, I think in a lot of ways. I mean, another faculty member and I are the faculty leaders of one of the teams in the teacher ed program here. We founded the team and we work on it. My wife works on it. It's sort of a very intense small group effort. But I think part of the vision behind what we want to do is produce teachers who can encourage kids' imaginations, and that the poetry doesn't seem to me at all different from the kinds of things that I would like teachers to be doing with children. I'm interested in teaching writing and poetry to kids, but I think more generally there's a sense that we would have a lot better schools if teachers could get more interested in and expert about helping kids to imagine intelligently. And that seems to me close to what poets try to do, too.
I would say there seems to be. You guys are all here tonight.
Here you are.
Wet Friday night. And are all going to buy Joe's book and my book. So.
Oh. Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think poetry probably goes through cycles just like everything else. I do think there is a lot of popular interest in it. And I think the, poetry readings around the country, people say, are better attended. There are the phenomenon of things like poetry slams and performance poetry. And I think the sensibility of a lot of people who learn about performance and words and music together in music videos and things like that is not so different. Or the intelligence it takes to read a commercial intelligently on television, I think is I think the kind of free-ranging mind that you get from a good poet.
I would add to that too. I think that poetry offers you access to things that you can't get otherwise, that feeds your imagination or spirit, and our modern lives conspire against that. So I think that's why a lot of young people come to creative writing classes and try to find that in using language in the service of understanding their own lives or touching whatever that other thing is. So, yeah. I think poetry moves so fast, and we're reading it to you. You're not sitting down with a text and having a much more intimate relationship with the page where you can stop and start. And so I think we readers have a tendency to, they want you to get the poem, so we probably do a little work in terms of setting that up so that you can, you know, follow on and not get caught thinking about a poem here while the poor poet's on to another poem already. And it's a way to pace a reading as well, as opposed to just simply reading a poem, reading a poem, reading a poem.
You're raising an interesting point, though. I mean, you don't want to clutter up a poem with a lot of surrounding text, you know. I mean, you want the poem to speak for itself. On the other hand, it's always a little more interesting if you have some background. And I think partly, too, you're touching on the fact that poetry has a double life, because it's both printed on the page and it's a voice speaking. And then when you hear it live, the voice speaking adds a real dimension to it. And even if the voice speaking alive then says, and by the way, this is about my uncle, it adds to it.
That too.
Well, actually, I learned when we were talking beforehand, Dennis spent a lot of time as a technical writer when he was living in Boston. And I've been a journalist much of my life. And I think it was a real discipline for me to not be prosy, to sort of really shift gears to thinking poetically and to using sort of images and music and sort of not exactly shutting off your rational mind, but turning it way down, because a poem is not an argument or an editorial in the New Republic magazine.
I haven't done a lot about. I've tried other kinds of writing. I've tried short stories and have bits and pieces of a novel somewhere. But I guess other kinds of writing, I haven't done a great deal of. My life is such that I don't get enough time to write poems, let alone other kinds of things. So for me, writing poetry is the focus.
I do think poetry slows you up in the sense that you read much more carefully. I mean, when I was a journalist, I used to gulp down, you know, newspapers and magazines and press releases and all that stuff. I can't read that fast now. I mean, partly it's age, I think, but also it's just that I don't want to read that fast anymore. And if the stuff isn't worth going slow for, don't read it.
I have a question for you. You talk about going out and finding a poem like a fish or something like that. How do you know when you found it?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if you actually go out and find anything. What you do is you ready yourself to find something. And then once you do that, you can't help but run into a poem. So it's getting yourself in a kind of a paying attention or an alertness to the things around you and the implications, the correspondences, the textures, the matrix. And you start looking at that and you start seeing connections, and then you'll find poems. So it's more of a kind of, you know, a meditative kind of thing. And then you'll find a poem. It doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter where you go. It's the mindset with which you go seek that thing. So if you can, it's a great thing to do. If you go out and begin hunting for it, you'll find it, it seems to me.
Well, you think you found the poem, and then it's something totally different.
Yeah. Well, the shroud of Turin, I dragged everybody too, because I knew that I had to see it, because something would, I didn't know what was going to happen, but I knew poems were there. The other poem I mentioned, I had no clue. I was just wandering on a Sunday morning and saw stuff that got connected for me.
I really wanted the dragonfly poem that I read. I really wanted that poem to be a very beautiful nature poem. And it didn't resist at arrest. I wanted to be a much darker poem. I mean, I'm just haunted by how beautiful dragonflies are. And for some reason, that wasn't what was up for that poem.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.